Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, the podcast that is dedicated towards helping to bridge the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for downloading these episodes, for sharing, liking, and subscribing. Please make sure that you continue to do that no matter what platform that you are listening to these episodes on, be it iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Spreaker, Stitcher, TuneIn, iHeartRadio, etc., etc., etc. Please make sure that you're hitting that like button. Don't be afraid to drop a comment. Hit me up. Let me know what you think, what you like about the show, what you don't like about the show. Remember to share it with a friend, a coworker, share it with a parent, with your brother, with your sister, someone in law enforcement, someone outside of law enforcement. Let them know that Captain Hunter is trying to bridge that divide between the police and the communities that they serve. Got a great episode for you today. We're going to talk about the monthly wrap-up, and we're going to talk about some of the items that have been going on around the country that will affect law enforcement. Now, of course, and clearly, I cannot and will not attempt to talk about every single episode concerning law enforcement around the country, but I think that there are some major stories and some major themes that we can take and we can really learn about going forward, right? So no matter where you live at, right, we can take these lessons that other people are doing in other parts of the country and try to implement them within our own law enforcement, with our own branches of government, within our own, as we'll learn about today, district attorney's offices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So just sit back, relax, take a listen, and please make sure that you hit that like, subscribe, and share button. And here we go. So I would be remiss not to talk about the tragic death of Kobe Bryant. Now, this is obviously not something that is law enforcement related, but also we talk about community issues, right? And this death to Kobe Bryant has really touched a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And one of the biggest ways that it has affected people, particularly those from the LA area, is that some people have been greatly saddened, obviously, right? To them, Kobe was a hero. Kobe was a mentor. Kobe was someone who helped build their own self-esteem, and so many other things that people have said, very kind words that people have said. Whether you like him or not, we watched Kobe Bryant grow up over the years, right? Drafted into the NBA at the age of 17 or 18 and retired around about the age of 37, 38, something like that. So for 20 years, we watched this man grow into an adult, his perspectives change and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, what has also been very frustrating, at least according to my own opinion, right, what has been very frustrating is the amount of negative attention that he has gotten. Yes, Kobe Bryant got in some trouble back in 2003 with a rape case, a sexual assault case allegations in Colorado. He then later settled that case for a public apology and probably some monetary damages back in 2005. So in the wake of his tragic death, many people have been bringing that up, you know, that he was nothing more than a rapist and yada, yada, yada. So the question that I would ask is, when is someone's past really in their past? The things that I've done, I'm 47 today, or actually I'm still 46, I'll be 47 in March 2020. The things that I've done when I was 17, 18, when am I going to be forgiven for those things? How long am I still that same person? How long are you still that same person? If you're 35 or 30, are you that same person that you were when you were 20? Are you making those same mistakes, right? We know that the human brain continues to develop and doesn't stop developing until about the age of 25, 26 or so. Kobe Bryant was on a journey just as the rest of us were. And this is really tied into what a lot of people want about criminal justice reform, particularly prison reform, right? Someone who gets arrested at the age of 18 or even 21, sentenced to 30, 40, 50 years in jail, or even 20 years in jail, prison. 10 years later, they're 21 when they get arrested, now they're 31. They have the benefit of hindsight in their rearview. They're not the same person that they were when they were 21. Now they're 35 and 41, right? You're not the same person. You have matured mentally. The question has to be asked, are you that same person? And are you as much of a threat to the public that you were when you were first incarcerated, first arrested? So this is the problem. This is the difficulty that many people are having And this is the conversation that many people are having when we talk about these types of incidents. And so I would put Kobe Bryant into this category. You know, of course he made mistakes. I'm not going to excuse sexual assault. I'm not going to excuse the fact that people want things to change. You know, in the interim years, we've had the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement. I have my own daughter. I have a wife. I have a mother, you know, cousins who are females. And I want them to be able to go to work and move about this society freely without the threat of sexual assault or the threat of sexual harassment. I don't think that that's unreasonable to ask of our society. But continuing to hold something against someone for years after, I mean, 2003 was 17 years ago, you know, 17 years ago is when this all occurred. So let's just think about that. And not only that, but, you know, we know that there have been a lot of social media memes. Now, fortunately, I have not read or seen any of these memes. Maybe it's just the friends that I have on social media who have not posted it. But I hear that there's a lot of people saying some very nasty and very harsh things about Kobe Bryant. And I did come across a story about an LA, East LA teacher, banned teacher at that, who went on for a 4-minute tirade, which was recorded by one of his students in class, talking about what made Kobe Bryant a great basketball player, also made him a terrible basketball player. I mean, why go on about that, right? As a band teacher, I don't know how old this man was, but as a band teacher, could someone say about you that what made you a great band teacher also made you a bad band teacher? What's the point and the purpose of this? The kids in class are more than likely mourning. This is their, in high school, more than likely, this is one of the heroes that they have grown up with, right? If you think about a high school student when they probably started watching basketball, my generation, we watched MJ, right? Michael Jordan. Kids today, you know, high school students will still remember Kobe Bryant in his heyday. And as they continue to watch LeBron James, what is gained by bashing these people? I've talked about before giving people their flowers while they can smell them. I think that that's very, very important. It makes no sense and does no good, but to bash people in this time of need. And I wish that we could all get this. And I'm not saying we have to praise him and love him and fawn all over him. People were Kobe fans or you weren't. People were LA Laker fans or you weren't. But to bash this man in his death, I think is very tactless, and to do it in a classroom setting where the students are there to learn about band, and they're there to, you know, these kids are mourning, you know, and to step on this man's grave before he's actually even in the grave, I think is very tactless. There was a Washington Post reporter suspended after she tweeted concerning the 2003 rape case against Kobe Bryant. So just not letting this man rest, right? People are hurt by this, and to bring up the past and bring up the pain and bring up the mistake that somebody made, as terrible as it was, you know, we can even have a debate as to whether it was actually a mistake or not. But to bring it up, you know, and to tweet about it, it really just says something more, I think, about you as an individual than I think that it says about Kobe Bryant. So he apologized for it. He went on to try to do some really positive things, helping other young players and starting schools or at least some type of preparatory schools and going on to write a children's book. Like I said, we're not the same person that we were at that time. So we've all made mistakes. We've all fallen short of some benchmark that we tried to reach. And if we followed you to the teacher, to the Washington Post reporter, to anyone, anywhere, throughout our whole life, would we be proud of every single decision that we made? Would your parents be proud of every single decision that you made when you were on college campuses? Just because we know about one person's dirt doesn't make our own dirt in our own backyard any less dirty, any less filthy, any less egregious. So just think about that. So that's enough about that. And I really hope that I gave you guys something to really think about. So let's get into some law enforcement news and what's going on around the country. One of the biggest things that's going on is a step in the right direction. I'll actually call it a half of a step in the right direction. And that is that Attorney General William Barr launches a presidential commission on law enforcement, right? This is going to be from the Washington Post. He launched a 16-panel group of individuals, mostly from law enforcement. They're going to be given 9 months to study law enforcement, and they're going to study an array of topics that concern law enforcement. Some of the topics that they're going to discuss are the challenges to law enforcement associated with mental illness, homelessness, substance abuse, and other social factors that influence crime and criminal justice resources. The recruitment, hiring, training, and retention of law enforcement officers, including in rural and tribal communities. Refusals by state and local prosecutors to enforce laws and prosecute categories of crime. We're going to talk about this in a little bit. We're going to stick a pin right there for a second. Going to come back to that. The need to promote public confidence and respect for law enforcement and law enforcement officers. And the effects of technological innovations on law enforcement and the criminal justice system, including the challenges and opportunities presented by such innovations. Now, I certainly don't have a problem with most of that, right? The challenges of mental health, substance abuse, homelessness, and other social factors. I think that needs to be studied. The recruitment, hiring, training, and retention of law enforcement officers, including in rural and tribal communities. Obviously, I think that that's important. We need more officers, particularly those of color. To be reflective of their communities and their environments. And there is a national trend around law enforcement where we can't get our people to want to enter into law enforcement. I think that that needs to be studied and needs to be dealt with. But we're going to come back to these next 2 points. We're going to really break down these next 2 points in a second here. Refusals by state and local prosecutors to enforce laws or prosecute categories of crime, and the need to promote public confidence and respect for law enforcement and law enforcement officers. I think that law enforcement, and concerning that last point that I just read about the public confidence, is really the fault of law enforcement. Law enforcement has to reach out. We have to be the ones, be the bigger people, to reach out to people and be community oriented, active in our communities, visiting churches, visiting parks, visiting social programs, and shooting hoops with kids, playing chess with kids, going bowling with kids, buying kids pizzas, handing out Halloween candy, handing out turkeys on Thanksgiving, doing what we have to do in order to be more visible within our communities. And until we do that, until officers do that, they will be seen as an occupying force and as a mistrusted force within this world. This is from the Washington Post. This commission, talking about the commission that William Barr is starting, is critical. This commission is critical, Barr said, because of the challenges posed by technology, as well as a wave of social problems such as homelessness, drug addiction, and mental illness that demand solutions beyond the expertise of police. Well, I agree with that statement, but as I'm going to read in a second here, he's employed hardly any people other than police on this commission. If you're thinking that substance abuse and mental health and all these social problems require the expertise beyond those of police officers, then why on the commission do you only have police officers? Further, Barr added, there has been, especially as of late, a disturbing pattern of cynicism and disrespect shown toward law enforcement. All Americans should agree that nobody wins when trust breaks down between the police and the communities they serve. We need to address this divide. Totally agree. We need to address it. The Attorney General also noted declines in police hiring and morale and said it was particularly alarming that last year more officers died by suicide than any year previously recorded. In fact, more officers died by suicide than in the line of duty last year. Something I talked about in previous episodes. Unfortunately, those episodes, the audio was so bad when I was in my beginning stages, but you may not be able to sit through it. I know I can't anymore. Anyway, I think that it's important that William Barr is addressing this, and I think that it needs to be addressed. You know, this problem that law enforcement is having, right, when they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and all the type of other type of mental problems, it's seen as a frustration, and officers are unfortunately killing themselves. The commission established from an executive order President Trump signed last year is required to submit a report and recommendations to the Attorney General by this coming October. After that, the Attorney General is going to submit a report to the president within 60 days of him receiving a report from this commission. Terry Cunningham, more from the Washington Post. Terry Cunningham, Deputy Executive Director of the IACP, that's the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and a former police chief, said that the 21st Century Task Force only focused on policing, while the new commission will examine all aspects of criminal justice system and how they interact. He said the 15 working groups will hold hearings, panel presentations, and field visits. More from the article. I don't think our justice system is broken. said Jonathan F. Thompson, Executive Director of National Sheriffs Association. Clearly, Jonathan F. Thompson is out of the loop. Our criminal justice system is broken. There is problems with it. Well, you know what? I'll take that back. It's not broken. It's designed and doing exactly what it was intended to do, and that is suppress the poor and make sure that the wealthy are taken care of. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in a second here. But that's exactly what the criminal justice is designed to do, and that's what it's doing. And so it's not broken. So Jonathan F. Thompson is absolutely right. But there are certainly elements of it that need resuscitation. That's resuscitation, right? We need to revive some things and review. This demonstrates that the Trump administration is really trying to get its arms around these issues at a local level. A number of observers expressed surprise that the commission is made up of entirely of law enforcement members, right? We talked about this in a little bit before. Cedric Alexander, you all will remember him. I had him on the podcast before. If you have not listened to that episode, please make sure you go back and listen to the episode with Cedric Alexander. The former president of the National Association of Black Law Enforcement Executives and a member of the 21st Century Task Force said he hoped going forward that they would consider incorporating those from the civil rights and human rights community into the platform because they would be able to add valuable insight into their mission. Alexander noted that Trump's commission does not include any chiefs from the nation's largest cities, which he said often face unique policing challenges. It's in the major cities where communities are most challenged with issues of crime and relationship building with the police, with social issues, he said. Adding a few major chiefs would expand and enhance the effectiveness of the commission. From the commission, the largest department that has a representation of from their chief of police is Wichita, Kansas, which is the 51st largest city in the nation. They do have police officers from Nashville and Dallas on this commission. Christian Clark, president of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, said it's unclear whether this group has commissioners who bring to bear expertise in critical civil rights issues such as racial disparities when it comes to use of excessive force, excessive or deadly force, stops and searches, and racial profiling. This commission also arises shortly following polarizing statement from Attorney General Barr suggesting that law enforcement need not protect communities that criticize police. Clark said the commission's agenda is clearly law enforcement driven and glaringly silent on issues that are front and center of communities of color. This kind of one-sided agenda is not likely to produce action items that will address systematic racial disparities impacting police today. Clark noted that Obama's 11-person task force had more diverse group of members with only three from law enforcement. So when Obama did his 21st century task force, they had 11 persons on it, and three of them were from law enforcement. Other persons were from other professions. Six of those people were people of color. On Trump's commission, three of its 16 members are people of color. That's enough of that, but it's a step in the right direction. I do agree with the criticisms that have been garnered, and that is that there's not enough people of color. There's not enough big city chiefs on the commission. There's only people from law enforcement on the commission. You need to have some mental health workers. If you want to address mental health and homelessness, you got to have experts from those communities who are willing to chip in and chime in and give their expertise. So it's my hope that these people from those from the commission will reach out to other experts outside of their field of expertise. Reach out to those who are specializing in homelessness and mental health and other social issues, communities of color, and reach out to them and say, how do we bridge this divide? How do we break down this problem? Address the issues of all these racial disparities and all that kind of stuff. It is a step in the right direction. So this is a very shocking story, and this ties in a lot to what is being talked about. When Attorney General Barr talks about the lack of respect, and when he talks about the lack of respect, and he talks about local district attorneys refusing to enforce the laws, here's exactly what we're going to talk about, right? Here's exactly the point of this. This comes from ABC News. Enough is enough. St. Louis Circuit Attorney defends lawsuit accusing racist conspiracy. So just a little bit of background about this particular story. Kim Gardner, who is the St. Louis Circuit Attorney, filed a federal lawsuit against the city and against its police union stating that all of the she's been getting harassed, and that the union and the police department is conspiring against her, and they don't want her to do her job, and they're upset about the reforms that she's trying to bring in. As a result of that, there has been an independent investigator who's been called to monitor her office and digging through her files, and this just general forms of harassment. Now, Kim Gardner has been fighting back, and she has actually filed this lawsuit claiming, going back to an 1871 law, a ruling about the Ku Klux Klan Act or law. Very, very interesting. So just a little bit from ABC News. Black elected prosecutors from across the country have come to the defense of St. Louis Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner, saying her federal lawsuit against the city and its police using alleging a coordinated racist conspiracy to drive her from office reflects a national trend. Prosecutors from California to Baltimore said that, similar to Gardner, they've endured smear campaigns by police unions and experienced a status quo mindset pervasive in local courts and government when attempts were made to push through criminal justice reforms, right? So these elected officials, right? Many of these circuit district attorneys have been elected, right? The will of the people, because they're running on platforms of police and criminal justice reforms. Because they're going against the status quo, the police union has been fighting it back against them. And this is not just something that's going on in St. Louis, Missouri, but this is a national trend in which many of these district attorneys, many of them black, African-American, many of them female, and this is the result that's going on. Gardner told ABC News in an interview on Tuesday that the lawsuit isn't about her. It's about constituents who want to see criminal justice reform in St. Louis that could level the playing field for minorities disproportionately affected by the current system. Gardner, a registered nurse and former funeral director, has managed to implement a diversion program for nonviolent defendants caught up in the justice system due to drug addiction. Her office has also stopped prosecuting people for low-level marijuana possession. But other reforms she proposed have been stymied, including wanting independent investigation of police-involved shootings. So this prosecutor wants an independent investigation when police shoot someone, and the fighting back of the police union has been to stop that. They don't want independent investigators looking into when they shoot someone. Think about that. This is not about Kim Gardner, she added. This is about certain individuals within these organizations that have gone beyond unprecedented amounts of coordination to stop the will of the people. I had no choice but to act for the will of the people because they want me to fight for what is right. On Monday, Gardner, the first black woman elected as chief prosecutor in St. Louis, filed a federal rights lawsuit against the city and its police union, alleging she's endured racist and illegal efforts from opponents to black reforms meant to benefit minorities. The suit accuses the city and police union of violating the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, designed to combat white supremacy organization. The suit also appears to mark the first time an elected local prosecutor has brought a federal case against the police union for racially motivated civil rights violation. The suit claims to take aim at entrenched interests that Gardner says had tried to prevent her reforms through a broad range of collusive conduct, including the appointment of a special prosecutor to investigate her office. The group of six black female prosecutors who went to St. Louis on Tuesday to rally support for Gardner said that they can relate to her struggles to buck the tide in implementing criminal justice reform. Quite candidly, Kim, like others who stand before you today, has challenged the status quo, and the keepers of the status quo don't like that, which is why she's being personally and professionally attacked, Baltimore City State Attorney Marilyn Mosby said in a news conference. Every prosecutor here has similar experiences to Kim. Mosby said she endured death threats and protests when her office prosecuted six Baltimore police officers after the 2015 death of Freddie Gray. Rachel Rollins, the Suffolk County District Attorney in Massachusetts, whose jurisdiction includes Boston, said Gardner's reputation is being besmirched because she dares to try and build a system that is just for everyone and not just those with wealth, power, and privilege. Remember, I talked about that a little bit before, right? People don't want change because it's protecting a certain group of people and because it is exploitative of the minority and poorer class of people. Amiris Ayala, state's attorney for Orange and Osceola counties in Florida, said she and other elected prosecutors supporting Garner in her legal fight represent diversity in the profession, and we represent diversity of thought that is new to our criminal justice system. Despite unprecedented attacks, we press on, Ayala said. Gardner's lawsuit cites data from the state's attorney general showing African Americans in Missouri are subjected to nearly twice as many traffic stops and arrests as whites. Several racist social media posts allegedly made by Missouri police officers are also listed in the complaint. In one, a former police division officer allegedly posted a photograph on Facebook of an African-American police officer standing with two African-American demonstrators, calling the officer Captain Hug-a-Thug and a disgrace to the uniform. Not exactly sure what's racist inherently about that, but that's what they wrote. And another, a lieutenant, is accused of posting, "I'm not sure what the hell is going on in our country these days. I drove by an authentic Mexican restaurant in town, and there are white guys putting on a new roof, cutting the grass, and doing landscaping." So I guess white people can't put on roofs, cut grass, and do landscaping. I guess that's something that's only for Mexican people, right? We regulate them to certain industries, and that's all you can do. Ridiculous. In another Facebook post, a Missouri officer wrote, according to the lawsuit, officer offered to sell t-shirt emblazoned with the word "Black Lives Splatter" because blue lives matter. These are police officers doing this, allegedly. The lawsuit also alleges that St. Louis Police Officers Association has gone out of its way to support white officers accused of perpetrating acts of violence and excessive force against African-American citizens, including the 2014 shooting of Michael Brown. Additionally, the St. Louis Police Officer Association paid the bail of Jason Stockley, a white officer shot and killed African-American motorist Anthony Lamar Smith in 2011, according to the lawsuit. Now, if that same SLPOA, St. Louis Police Officers Association, does not pay for the bail of a black officer who is accused of shooting someone, then they are wrong. Clearly, they are wrong. Garner, who sought to launch several police reforms, including improving investigations of police misconduct in St. Louis, received threatening letters to her office that were filled with racial invective. In some of the letters, Garner was called racial slurs and various sexist expletives. So that's a little bit what's going on. You can continue reading on that in ABC News. So I thought it was very interesting that she chose this 1871 act, the Ku Klux Klan Act. Now, I'm not very familiar with that. I'm not a lawyer or an attorney. But just reading a little bit about it, you know, different various websites, it, apparently this was a law that was enacted to help to enforce the Reconstruction efforts, mostly in South Carolina, but across the board. After the Civil War, right, Reconstruction goes on. Black people are being voted into office. Black people are allowed to vote. They're becoming normalized, naturalized citizens and able to express all of their rights, right? So they had to pass these laws, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment to the Constitution. And one of the laws that helped to enforce this was this Ku Klux Klan Act, which helped to break up the Ku Klux Klan in any group that would seek as a group of people with interest in supporting and maintaining white supremacy. So that is essentially what Ms. Gardner is suing them under, is that this group, right, the St. Louis Police Association and the city, her allegations are, is that they are seeking and banding together under the white supremacy in order to thwart the efforts of this one black citizen who has the right to, who is essentially going to impact the lives of many other black citizens, right? Every person who under color of statute, ordinance, regulation, custom, or usage of any state or territory in the District of Columbia subjects or causes to be subjected, any citizen of the United States or other person within the jurisdiction thereof to be to the deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the Constitution and laws shall be liable to the party injured in an action of law, suit in equity, or any other proper proceeding for redress. Right? So, you know, a lot of that is a lot of legalese. I don't really understand a lot of it, but this is what Ms. Garner is seeking to do. So I hope the justice prevails. And if it is true that the right? This is only one side of the story. We're getting one side of the story. I'm sure that the facts will be borne out in court. But if this is true, then, you know, I hope that justice comes for Ms. Gardner and for all these other state's attorneys, district attorneys across the nation who are feeling the brunt of this, right? They're from California to Baltimore, down to Florida, to Massachusetts. Many of these state's attorneys feel as if their efforts for towards criminal justice reform are being thwarted by those who have a vested interest in keeping the status quo. A sad part of and a sad reality about law enforcement is that it is an institution, it is a system. And unfortunately, that system needs to feed upon people. What do I mean by that? Prison systems as a union have been supportive of the continued criminalization of marijuana and other drugs. Now, you have to think about why these unions would stand behind some kind of policy like that. Well, if more people, because obviously more people need to be arrested so that these people can be housed and incarcerated. And so therefore, the prison officials can continue to have their jobs. Same thing with law enforcement, right? If you stop criminalizing and decriminalize marijuana and other drugs and stop prosecuting people for simple possession, then the arrests go down. And therefore, what are the police going to do, right? So this is unfortunately a vicious cycle that Ms. Gardner is seeking to stop, this overcriminalization of people, of minority communities, poor people. And so a lot of police officers are fighting back against that because, okay, if we're not arresting people for drugs, then what are we doing all day, right? Why, how can we justify our numbers? How can we justify our salary? So on and so on. I hope that justice prevails and I hope that the truth comes out for her. And I hope that it sets a precedent for all those prosecutors in other counties. We talked about traffic stops, some of the things that Ms. Gardner was looking into in St. Louis. Another story that comes from Chicago is the ACLU is asking why minorities are still pulled over much more than whites, right? So something that the ACLU is looking into from the Chicago Tribune. The American Civil Liberties Union is asking why minorities are still pulled over much more often than whites, despite court order reformed by City Hall. Drivers of color continue to be stopped at higher percentages than their estimated local driving population. And they are asked to consent to searches more frequently with less contraband found than white drivers. There were roughly 490,000 traffic stops in Chicago streets last year, more than 200,000 than the previous year, according to the data from Illinois Department of Transportation. It was the third consecutive year of sharp increases. About 86%, 421,000, involved minority motorists. Of those, 300,000 were black. That's 61% of the total number of people stopped in Chicago in 2018. Even though African Americans are about 31% of the city's 2.7 million population, nearly 68,000 of the stops involved white motorists. There is a story here. Let me give the other side of the equation so we can understand this. Many times, and we have to look at this, are African Americans committing more traffic violations? That question has to be asked. Are we committing more traffic violations? I know that when we had a study in Connecticut concerning the same thing, in my own home city, we were found to be stopping African Americans more. Unfortunately, a lot of times, here's what's happened. Take this for what it's worth, and it's the honest to goodness truth. I think that you know by now, I'm not going to give you some BS, is that officers are often targeting areas and neighborhoods where crime is happening. It's just a fact. It's just a fact, and we want that, right? If there's a shootings and gang activity in certain neighborhoods, then we need to target those neighborhoods. And if we can stop people, if we can perform these type of motor vehicle stops and get people to understand that there is a certain police presence, then that only works in the favor, right? And it helps to bring down the shootings and everything like that. It's only one of the tactics that is used to address crime in certain neighborhoods, and that's one of the tactics. So we had to be very careful about when we asking law enforcement not to stop certain people because they are black. And many times, and I'm going to ask you to do this as you listen to this, drive down the street and try to tell what the race is of the person in front of you, right? Many times you cannot tell. Many times you cannot tell the race of the person who's driving in front of you. Then people have tinted windows nowadays and you cannot see into their windows. And so many times you don't know. But a person who's in front of you, who runs a stop sign, who refuses to, who speeds up at that yellow light and tries to beat that light, that red light. Many times you don't know what the race of that person is. So the first thing I'm going to ask is, what is the race? What is, who is committing more of these types of infractions, right? First thing Black people have to do is stop committing more of these infractions. I don't know the numbers and statistics of Chicago, but I do know that when we were approached concerning these types of measures, that we were able to justify the fact that what we were doing, when we gave the information as to where the crimes were happening, where our shootings were happening, where our street level robberies were happening, and then we showed that our enforcement actions and activities were geared towards those particular neighborhoods and those particular areas. And so therefore, once again, we were stopping people who were committing infractions, motor vehicle stops, in those areas. And that's what we were doing. So that may be exactly what Chicago is doing. If that is what's going on, then I give them my wholehearted and full support in what they're doing. And that needs to be understood by people, right? So just because you got to be very careful when you look at numbers and statistics, because there may be reasons behind this. I'm not saying not to look into it. I'm not saying that the ACLU and other watch groups should not look into these matters, but there may be a justification for it, right? There may be a justification for what's going on. So you can read more about that in the Chicago Tribune. The name of the article is, "As Traffic Stops by Chicago Police Spike, ACLU Asks Why Minorities Are Still Pulled Over Much More Than Whites." Sticking with Chicago just for a minute here, this was a story, I think, from December, but I'll mention it again here again, is that this new interim police chief that they have has decreased the or eliminated the merit system for promotions. And I think that that's very key. When we talk about police corruption, when we talk about why police officers plant drugs on people, why they are selling drugs and trying to boost up their numbers and trying to increase their arrests, what the question is, why a lot of times are they doing that? Well, the merit system is essentially when someone's going up for promotion, if Chicago has some type of a testing process, i.e. a written test and maybe some type of oral board presentation, then maybe another component of that testing process is the merit test, right? So how many arrests do you get? How many drugs are you getting off the street? How many guns are you able to find? How many arrests? How many tickets? How many citations? And so therefore, officers are judged by that. So maybe you want a promotion. Maybe the officer wants a promotion. Maybe they want a special assignment to work with the DEA or to join some type of narcotics or gun task force. And so they want to show that they have that ability to find drugs, to get drugs off the street, to make these arrests and things like that. By taking away this merit system, you take away the incentive for officers to plant drugs on people because they're not trying to boost their numbers. You take away the officers' incentive for arresting people because you take away the incentive to do that, right? So maybe they've implemented something more strict, is now more of a academics, right? So now it's how well you perform on these tests, right? Written and oral. So I think that that's very important, very, very important and very good on their part. So let's just finish up here. California police, this is another story that's going around the country where many people, I think even Chicago had a problem with this as one time as well, that California police are false labeling people as gang members. It's part of a bigger crisis. If they label people as gang members, right, most of them obviously are minority people, labeling them as gang members, they get harsher sentencing guidelines. Mostly the consequences of this are harsher sentencing guidelines. But once you get labeled as a gang member, right, it's hard to get your name off of this list, right? You're labeled as a young kid. And if you're caught in the wrong place at the wrong time, doing the wrong, probably even doing the wrong thing, then you've got this label on you as a gang member, right? You're in this database and now they're going to treat you a different way. And so it's easy to get on this gang member list, right? Maybe if you're seen hanging with these people or wearing a certain color, walking down the street, you know, the getting onto this list can be very easy, and getting your name off of this list is incredibly, incredibly difficult. So that's something we can keep an eye on. But this comes from the Intelligencer, nymag.com. California police are falsely labeling people as gang members. It's part of a bigger crisis, right? So again, you have to watch out for people who have their own vested interests at this. Are there incentives for officers to find more gang members, right? If you got to go out there and get us more gang members and do your job and get more drugs off the street, if you can't find them legally, right? Or now you can't find people actually doing what they're doing. So now you're just, I saw, you know, a well-known gang member. He's eating lunch with his nephew. And now I'm going to label that nephew as a gang member. Well, that's unfair to the nephew, right? Is he actually been seen committing gang crimes? I'm putting up quotations there, right? Is he being seen committing gang crimes and all that kind of stuff? So you have to be very, very cautious about who is being placed on this. We understand that there's been going to be some reforms concerning what's going on in Mississippi. Mississippi's had some riots. At least 10 people, the last report that I heard, have been killed. One of them has died by suicide. The new incoming governor down there in Mississippi has promised reforms. Apparently, he's taken a tour of the prisons down there and called the conditions that the people down there are living in terrible. He's promised to crack down on corrupt COs, right? The corrections officers, cut down on the cell phones. How these inmates are getting cell phones is most obviously through the corrections officers bringing them in. The corrections officers may have gang ties themselves and being given kickbacks and things like that. This is a story that's going to be going on and growing on. So fortunately, you know, people like Jay-Z and others are filing lawsuits on their behalf and just trying to bring some sense to this insanity, because it's crazy that this is going on, right? And I think that one of the reasons, and I'm going to say this cynically, is one of the reasons that they don't want these cell phones in there is because some of the videos and pictures were getting out, and they obviously they don't want the pictures and videos getting out. But let's take a more positive respect and say that one of the reasons that the governor is giving for one of the crackdown on the cell phones, of course, I threw that in there about the pictures getting out to the public. But one of the reasons is that the governor's claiming that this is how the prison inmates are coordinating attacks and things like that. So, which is completely possible. You know, I don't doubt that at all. So you got to make sure that the officers and the good COs and corrections officers and the inmates and whatever are safe. So that's fine. So the last story I want to talk about for today is a story that comes from rare.us. And the name of the story is "A Man Calls Cops on Girlfriend for Being Too Rough During Sex." Unbelievable. If you go to that story, right, you can read it. You can look at the mugshot of this lady. Here's it from the article. "Just look at this mugshot. I love it. Does this really look like a person who could do damage? No, it doesn't. But apparently this evil, evil woman did. So much so she was arrested. 24-year-old Kristen Paris was booked in the Davidson County Jail after her boyfriend, Taylor Hayes, called police when she got too rough with him during sex." Unbelievable. "Can you imagine having to call your mom from jail saying you were arrested for having a wild night of passionate sex?" According to authorities, Metro Nashville police were dispatched to Hayes' apartment on January 1st for a domestic assault call. Hayes told police that his girlfriend began to bite and scratch him during sex, and it was way beyond the scope of their normal intimacy. Hayes showed police two bite marks, one in his arm and one along his back, with several scratch marks to his back. Unreal. I'm not even going to read the rest of that story. Just ridiculous. You got to call the police over that. And the police arrested her. Jeez. I get the domestic violence in many cases and circumstances. Many states have taken the authority away from the complainant and from the police, right? We no longer have discretion to make arrests. You have to make an arrest. And so here's what we're left with. This guy calls the cops on his girlfriend because she scratched up his back and was biting him during sex. And so the police, bound by laws, handcuffed, can't make any kind of discretionary decisions to have the party separate for the night or anything like that, to go their own ways, has to make an arrest. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying, and I actually agree with much of the case laws, much of the decisions by the courts and the legislature who have said that the police should not be able to have discretion in actual domestic violence cases, right? When one person is mad at the other one and you're doing threatening behavior and physical violence. But here's a case of sex. So cooler heads have to prevail and all this kind of stuff. But so I just thought I'd leave you with a little bit of levity on that. Thank you very much for tuning into Captain Hunter's podcast. If you have any stories, make sure that you send them to me so I can read them through the month. Still got a lot of great episodes coming up, a lot of great interviews. That's it. Much love and much peace.